Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. My name is Michael.
And my name is Andreas. We are on a mission to explore Amazon Web Services. Listen to the Cloudonaut podcast to deepen your AWS knowledge, stay up to date, and get inspired. Every month, we discuss a topic about all things AWS in this podcast. This time, we are talking about serverless in the enterprise. This is episode number 39, and we are recording on March 17th, 2021. A short announcement before we start. Subscribe to our newsletter to get our latest content delivered into your inbox weekly. And by the way, we are raffling a one-year subscription for Cloudonaut Plus among all subscribers every month. You will find the details and a link in the show notes. Let's get started. So as I said, Michael, so I coached a few developers and small teams building their first serverless applications, and they were working in large enterprises. So this was basically the setting, and I want to share my learnings and observations about that. So maybe the first question that I want to discuss is when we talk about serverless and the enterprise. So first of all, a lot of things are similar, no matter if you do it in the enterprise or in a small company. But I think some of the discussions and some of the aspects differ a little bit. So let's start with the why. So why is going serverless a thing to do also for enterprise customers? So I think, in my opinion, going serverless really enables you to build scalable and fault-tolerant systems on AWS, and to do that on a layer of abstraction on top of the infrastructure as a service offerings that AWS comes with. And this solves some challenges out of the box. So a few examples. So you're avoiding idle resources, and you don't need to configure scaling your infrastructure in any way. So if you want to achieve that based on virtual machines or even on containers, there's a lot of things that we need to configure. So basically, you need to find a metric for scaling and stuff like that. And that's totally abstracted away when we do serverless. The other thing that I find, which is quite important for a good argument for going serverless, is if you want to automate the deployment process and in a way that it doesn't affect in-flight requests, that's basically also a challenge that is not too easy to accomplish, even with containers and stuff. But with serverless, we get all of that out of the box. Yeah, you just basically you can click a button, or even better, have a infrastructure's code template that does this for you. So this is built into the serverless offerings of AWS. And last but not least, I think also an important part of serverless is you can really automate every part of the cloud infrastructure very easily, because there's no such thing as a server where you need to run configuration management or something like that. So basically, all you need is configurable via an AWS API.
All right, Andreas. So maybe I will add something here. So I'm not sure if everyone of our listeners is aware of what enterprise actually means. So, and this is not going to be a like perfect definition, but what I think what differentiates the enterprise from a smaller, medium-sized or startup company is that A, they have a lot of existing IT infrastructure. So usually there's lots of interfaces that are integrated. And on the other hand, they are, I would say, in a way regulated. And that could be because of internal policies that they have. So for example, could be about data encryption, could be about not exposing stuff to the internet. But there could also be external requirements, for example, we think of GDPR, so data needs to be processed within the European Union, like personal data if it comes from a European citizen, stuff like this. So you can think of this as like there's lots of IT already, and then there is lots of rules, internal rules and external rules that you need to consider. And I think that's what an enterprise is kind of, or what is defining of the term enterprise here in this context.
Yeah, definitely. The The next aspect that I want to discuss, which is also different, I think, for in startups or small companies compared to the big ones, so is the people, basically, the people problems that you're facing. So I will say, when you introduce the idea of building the first serverless architecture, the first serverless application within an enterprise company, that will probably not go down very well. So that's what I've experienced. So a lot of people will show up with concerns, all different kinds of concerns. So Michael, what are the typical concerns in enterprise companies? I would say the first is typically we want to be vendor agnostic. We don't want to have lock-in into a technology. That's probably a basic one. What else do you know from enterprise customers?
Yeah, so like running or like Windows, but complaining about vendor login. So that's number one. Then number two is security in like very abstract terms. So no matter what it actually means, but it's security. Is it secure?
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the two main concerns, and both of them are not very. Like there is not really a argument that you can really kind of talk about because it's very abstract and there is no real concrete problem with it. It's more like a general thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably a good one. Then maybe the other thing is, are other enterprise customers using that kind of technology as well? Is it basically too bleeding edge? Do we really want to use an unproven technology that might come up? It changes too fast, stuff like that. Is it mature? That's maybe what's behind all of that. Then people will start maybe talking about costs. So we cannot calculate costs for serverless infrastructure upfront. So I think there are many, many arguments that you can come up if you want to make a point against building a serverless application. From my experience, I would say most of those arguments are pseudo arguments. So it's not really a good argument to make, but it will be hard to argue against those arguments. Basically, that's what I see, and I think it comes down to this is really a people problem. So when you build your first serverless application, if you start a first project in your organization, I think what you basically do is you're starting a change process. And this always is not the easiest thing to do in the world, I would say. So from my experience, how do you tackle that? So how to go through that phase? And basically what I find is the best way to do it is find a small project and a small team with highly motivated people to build the first serverless application within the organization. So leave out all the people that have arguments against it. Try to get management support. That's essential. And then just with a very small team with as less dependencies as possible, deliver a solid solution. And then present that solution to the organization. And I think the word about it will spread automatically. That's what I learned. And more people will come down the road and will say, we want to build our first serverless project as well. So that's what I've observed in many different organizations. It's always the pattern that someone has to start. And to build the first project successfully, I think it's important to have as less dependencies to the, let's say, old world as possible, and to have really a small team if possible, that are really highly motivated to build something with that new technology. And I think then everything else will follow. And over time, probably over years, actually, more and more projects and teams will follow that road.
Yeah, I see. And I can like agree that this is a way that works. So I saw that in projects as well. And sometimes it was the same project, Andreas, but it was also sometimes other clients that we worked for. So that is usually the best idea. I mean, you need a small team and they start, and then we hope that the rest will follow. So when talking about people, Andreas, so what kind of skills do I have to look out for, or what are the skills that I have to develop or kind of train in my team to be successful?
Yeah, very good question, Michael. I think that's basically a good course Building a serverless application is really totally different than building an application in a way that we did for on-prem or even for deploying it on containers or virtual machines. And I came up with a learning path, basically with a list of AWS services or parts of AWS that are important for building serverless application. I want to go through them. So I think it starts with identity and access management, which is basically authentication authorization on AWS. I think that's an important one. The next thing is Lambda, so the serverless compute engine, I would say. So learn about really the deep technical details here. It's important to know all about the limitations, about the way things work, what's different compared to a virtual machine. So really dive into the details there. Then there are the services to store data. S3 is, I would say, probably there's no serverless application without S3 involved, I would say, for the object store. Then DynamoDB, popular NoSQL database for a serverless application. We will discuss the database choices later, but I think that's still you need to know a little bit about it, even if you don't want to use it. Then there is API gateway, so learn how to build basically a REST or GraphQL API for your serverless application. Next topic is infrastructure as code. So I would say nowadays the cloud development kit, CDK, CloudFormation, maybe the serverless framework, those are things to look into. I would also say that OAuth serverless should be on the roadmap for learning serverless. So a SQL-like database that you can use. And then I would say going into the AWS SDKs, so the software development kits that you can use to basically talk to the AWS APIs. So you need to get familiar with those as well. So that's what I would say is what is really important to learn when going into serverless.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, those are all AWS technologies. And I might would add something additionally, because sometimes this is kind of a surprise. And this is especially true in the enterprise context. You also need to understand or learn a programming language. Because if you cannot write your Lambda functions in, for example, JavaScript, in Python, in Ruby, in Java, or whatever other languages are available, then you are in troubles as well. And those skills are not necessarily available in the enterprise context. And if you want to create a UI, you also need someone who is able to create a front end for your enterprise application. And that usually is using web technologies. Mm-hmm. So those are also skills that might need to be trained depending on the team. Yeah, because, for example, there are very often very large frameworks used in the enterprise to create applications where it might not be necessary to actually deal with the UI because it's all generated and things like that. But that will likely change here in this context. So yeah, those are maybe two skills that you have to make sure that this is also somehow available in the team. Otherwise, it will get very hard to do something actually. Yeah.
And I think also that is an important, that is maybe a disadvantage of serverless at all, because I think all of that what we have discussed, or most of that, is something that enterprise organizations do not have the skills for. So they need to build those skills by training people, by hiring experts. So I would say most of the organizations that I've seen, they're really starting from scratch here. And that's definitely, I would say, a disadvantage, because you have to invest to make that, you have to build up that skill set, basically. Okay.
Yeah. So maybe one example before we continue, Andreas. So adding a form to a website, I mean, that sounds very easy if you're using things like there are big frameworks like Apex or stuff like this. And if you want to add a form, like in the serverless context, okay, what do we need to do? Okay, we need somehow the front end. We need somehow to create this HTML, which is the form. We need input validation. Oh my God. So how to add this on the front end? Then we need an API gateway to send this data to. There we need to do maybe authentication. We might need to do input validation again. So how do we do this again? And then we need to do something with the data. And I mean, that's all something that you have to kind of deal with. It's not automatically taken care of. So serverless is not really, it's not a framework, it's more the approach, I would say. And this is has to be something that, that you have, or you have to be aware of that, that it, it actually doesn't help you at all to get form data into your database.
Definitely, yeah. So next, I want to talk about the compute part. So when you think about a serverless architecture, Lambda is the obvious choice for the compute layer. So Lambda allows us to execute our source code without needing to take care of the infrastructure beyond that. But I think what's important to know is that Lambda comes with a few limitations. So compute, memory, networking resources are much more limited than, for example, when spinning up an EC2 instance. Special requirements for CPU, GPU, memory, or something can sometimes only be met very difficult or not at all. And then we have stuff like the function invocation timeout, which is 15 minutes right now. So we need to slice our problem into chunks that Lambda can process within less than 15 minutes. And important is even the outliers need to be processed within that time frame. I think that is really important. And so from a developer perspective, I think another thing that, that is important to understand is that Lambda really runs your code in the cloud. And it's not that easy to build up a development environment on your local machine that replicates that. So some use some tooling for that. There are tools available, but you need to basically find out which works for you and implement that. Others don't do it at all. They just deploy everything to a test or development environment and test it there. But I would say to have an efficient development workflow, you need to invest in some tooling or basically to get familiar with the setup. So that's different than just building a simple Java application or something that you just run on your local machine. So I think that is important to know when we talk about compute and Lambda for serverless. The alternative on a compute layer is, I would say, maybe Fargate. So now some say Fargate, so the container service basically, is not really serverless. I'm not sure if it's really worth to go down that discussion. So I don't care about this discussion. But I think the similarity is with Fargate, we also are able to run our source code on AWS without spinning up EC2 instances, without taking care of virtual machines. What is a little bit different is we have a long-running container, a long-running process, which on the one hand, from a billing perspective, we are back into that bill per hour, bill per minute thing. On the other side, from a programmer's perspective, we have a long-running process, which is very similar to what we have been doing for years and maybe decades before on-premise or even in the cloud. So the programming model is very similar to what people already know about. So that is maybe the important thing here to mention.
Yeah, and the big advantage that comes with that is that you can use your existing frameworks. So you can use a Spring framework, for example, run your application or develop your application using the Spring framework, which helps you a lot to get like all this, for example, data input validation and stuff like this. I mean, it's all built in. So you can reuse that skills and you can reuse that technology. And that's helpful. So yeah, keep that in mind when you choose the compute layer. That's right. Yeah.
So of course there are some baseline costs when going the Fargate way. You also have to scale it with your own metrics and stuff. But I think it's at least worth considering Fargate as an alternative. And I would also say Fargate on ECS, which is much less complex. So yeah, Lambda is the obvious choice. But I think keep in mind that Fargate might be an option as well. Okay, so the next topic I want to discuss, this is really an enterprise topic. Now we're coming to net, and the network is basically in every enterprise project, no matter what you do. Basically, the network is what slows down everything because the network has grown over years and decades in those enterprises. There are lots of different teams typically involved for, I don't know, DNS, firewalls, all that stuff. So it's typically very, very complicated to configure and to get network connectivity in those enterprise customers. So when we talk about serverless applications, I think the important thing to see here is typically our AWS basically designed all the services like API Gateway, Lambda, DynamoDB, and all of that. That's really designed as web services. So that means all of them are accessible via an internet-facing API. And also the API Gateway by default just provides you an internet-facing API that you can consume. And so it's really designed for building applications for the internet. And now in the enterprise world, that's something that most organizations are totally unfamiliar with, because the default is we build all our applications for the internet, for internal private networks only. Because there's still that thinking that this is the most secure way of doing things. We want to have it on our in our own networks under our control. And I think that's where really the two things clashes, the culture of the network in enterprises and then what serverless is doing. I think that is important. And because I think with serverless, really the idea is we have a web application, a web service. We do strong authentication, authorization. Of course, we rely on stuff like TLS and so on to make it secure. But it's accessible over the internet. And now the question is it possible to build a serverless application for the internal network only? So that's something I've been doing recently. And I wanted to share a little bit of the learnings here. And what we didn't mention here is, so there will be two blog posts that we will publish along with this podcast episode. You will find the links to that in the show notes. So if you want to read the stuff that we are discussing right now, check them out. And also now, as we are diving a little bit more into the technical details, you will find example code and stuff like that in that blog post as well. So that might be worth checking it out. So how do you build a serverless application that is only accessible via VPN or maybe a direct connect connection? So first of all, it's possible, but it's quite complicated to do so. But let's talk through that a little bit.
So what's the alternative, Andreas? Maybe before we go down the hard path, I mean, you could also convince the people in the enterprise that running stuff in the internet is not a problem, but that will probably take you 5 years. we present you an idea that might take half a year, so you can get your serverless application out in the internal network. Maybe you can also work in parallel on making sure that the mindset changes in the next couple of years.
I think also the mindset in those enterprise companies, it starts to change slowly. So I think many organizations work on stuff like how can we provide APIs or even web applications by making them accessible to the internet. Because enterprise customers are facing problems like remote work, connecting with third parties, stuff like that. So it's obvious that the internet is the easiest choice here. But I think it will take probably a few years until we are at that point. It might be a shortcut to just start with a serverless application that is only accessible via intranet, so only via VPN or direct connect. So basically it is serverless for hybrid cloud. So I always try to run away when someone is building a hybrid cloud, but that's how it is. Okay, so how can you achieve that? So what's the architecture that you can up? So the assumption is we are building a serverless application, including a backend and a frontend. So typically that is you have a REST API and you have a single page application, for example, written in Angular or with React or something like that. So that's the overall goal. So how do we build up the serverless infrastructure for that? And also an assumption that I want to make here is we have the corporate network, which is connected to your AWS VPC. Let's say via VPN, it works the same way when you have a direct connect connection as well. Okay, so that's the setup that we have. And now the question is, how does the serverless architecture look like? So it starts, of course, with an API gateway. So the API gateway allows us to build up a REST API and to forward incoming requests to a Lambda function to build a backend. Yeah, so to probably the Lambda function then connects to a database, fetches data, and so on. So that's the obvious part. So now we want to have that in the private network. So what the API REST gateway, so this is one of the options that AWS provides, is also able to build, it's possible to configure it as a private API gateway, which means it's only accessible from within the VPC. And it only has, only allows internal network connectivity. So that's the first thing we need. Now the problem that we have, and that's basically the thing, to be able to connect to that, we create also a VPC endpoint. So that is allowing us to send traffic from our VPC and also, by the way, over the VPN connection to our API gateway. The thing here is now there's a limitation with the private API gateway, and that is it does not support custom domain names. So let's say you want to have myapp.local.mycompany.com as the domain name for your application, also for the front end, because users need to interact with it. You need a speaking, rememberable domain name. The problem is that the API gateway with the private configuration does not support that. It's supported for the internet-facing ones, but not for the internal ones. So that's a bummer. And how to overcome that problem? So one solution that I found and others are using, and I've been using it for two serverless applications now, is you add an application load balancer to your architecture. And basically now what you can do is you have the application load balancer that handles the TLS and the custom domain name as it used to be. And it forwards the requests. So the targets of the load balancer basically are the IP addresses of the VPC endpoint that you created pointing to the application load balancer. And by doing that, you basically add another layer that is capable of adding that custom domain name capabilities, because it terminates the TLS connection and sends that to the API gateway.
Okay, Andreas, one question. So just to make sure that I understand it correctly. So we use this approach both for static assets like the images, CSS, JavaScript, and we also use it to invoke the API and get fetch some data, post some data and stuff like this. Is this correct?
Yes, exactly. That I forgot to talk about that. Absolutely. So the static assets, so that's the next question. So if you build a single page application, we have compiled JavaScript, CSS, HTML, stuff like that. And the typical way of delivering that assets is to have an S3 bucket and then to deliver it from there to the users, to the browsers. The way I solve that problem is because, again, if you want to have that over the internal network and not through internet, typically you would do CloudFront and S3. That's the simple solution, but then that goes over internet and not through your internal network. So yeah, one solution is to have the API gateway forward those requests to the S3 bucket. So you can configure API gateway not only for Lambda, but also for other AWS services like S3. And by doing that, basically, you can have the same mechanism that we discussed for the backend and for the front end. That's definitely one way of solving that problem.
Okay, I see. And now I have one additional question, and then I think I'm done. So, I mean, we can run the Lambda function in VPCs as well. So we can make sure that, and then I think we need lots of endpoints, like connect to CloudWatch logs, connect to maybe DynamoDB, connect to whatever we want to access. But if the API when the API gateway invokes the Lambda function, I mean, that will be done over public internet, right?
Don't tell anyone yet. So, or at least, so we don't know. So we have no control over that part of the network. Yes, that's correct. Because the API gateway, actually, I don't think that is specified how that works, but I would assume it's just using the public API. So probably, so most likely, of course, AWS will not route that traffic over internet because it doesn't make any sense. They will route it through their own networks, of course.
Okay, I see.
But we don't have any control over that. Yeah, that's correct, Michael. But usually no one is going into that much detail here. Yeah, good point. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so that's the solution. It's quite complicated to set things up. So check out the blog post. I have Terraform examples in there if you want to rebuild something like that. I think that could be very helpful. Maybe one last thing about that topic. An alternative to that is you can also just much more easier have an application load balancer that invokes Lambda functions right away. So by that, the whole infrastructure, serverless infrastructure, becomes much simpler. But of course, you're losing all the functionalities from the API gateway. So the authorization part, the throttling part, then you have to all of that build that on your own. So I've used this approach with ALB pointing directly to a Lambda function for very, very simple APIs where I had full control over the clients as well. But it's probably, yeah, it's an alternative, but it comes with limitations as well. Also, worth noting, I haven't tested it yet, but AWS introduced a so-called interface VPC endpoint for S3 as well. So that is very helpful if you want to access an S3 bucket over a VPN connection, which was not possible before. But yeah, as I said, I haven't done it yet, but I think it should be possible now as well. So that might simplify it as well a little bit. Okay, so I would say to summarize that discussion, so as we said, try to convince the organization to build an internet-facing application because it's much more, much simpler. And if not, there are ways to build it for an internal network as well, but it's getting a lot more complex. So the next thing I want to add to the discussion is let's discuss about the databases. So what are the options here? The database options, I would say, are basically you have two valid options. One is DynamoDB. The other is Aurora Serverless. And maybe to make that argument here, DynamoDB is, I would say, is more serverless than Aurora Serverless because you pay per request, but it is a NoSQL database, and it's much harder to get your head around that. So especially for teams that are starting to build with their first application, it might be easier to go with Aurora Serverless. And one important aspect of Aurora Serverless is it's a SQL-like database, so it comes with Postgres or MySQL compatible interfaces. And it also comes with a data API, which is important in the context of Lambda. So it's also a good option, I would say, for building serverless applications here. So in summary, I would say when the data schema and the query patterns are very straightforward, then I think it's maybe an option to go with DynamoDB. But I would say serverless, Aurora Serverless, is a good alternative. And especially if you want to make it a little bit easier for developers and architects to start with serverless, it might be a good thing to go with Aurora Serverless for the first project, maybe.
Yeah, I can agree. And maybe one warning, if this is your first serverless project in the enterprise, don't try to use the single table design for DynamoDB. So it's not made for you. So this is like, if you are bored after your fifth serverless application, then you can look into that, but don't start with it. It doesn't make any sense for an application used by 50 users. It is completely unmaintainable. It doesn't make any sense for small applications. It's just wasting your energy. So yeah, keep that in mind. So don't make it harder than it has to be. Use technology that you are familiar with if possible. For example, if you're familiar with SQL databases, then go with it, because you have to learn a lot of new stuff already. So you can keep or take a shortcut here. And it's working fine. Lots of people are using it, and it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so the last thing that I want to discuss is, I think what is important when we talk about serverless is to have that in mind that actually we're talking about highly distributed systems. And I think that's the challenge that organizations face when they start with their first serverless projects. Because in the old days, in the good old days, we had an application, we had a database, maybe they were running on the same machine, maybe on two different machines. It was not really a highly distributed system. It might be have distributed among two or three machines, actually. With serverless, we are entering a whole different world. Because Lambda, DynamoDB, S3, all of that runs on hundreds of machines, maybe thousands probably, of machines in parallel. So a lot of things change from what you have to have in your basically in your mental model of all of that. So what the benefits are that provisioning and maintaining this is simple, but basically writing the code for that becomes much more complex. That's what I would say is the trade-off that we have here. A few examples why it becomes more complex. For example, Michael, you have written a blog post about that a few years ago. There is no guarantee that Lambda executes your code only once when you invoke a function. So it's possible, and probably it only invokes it once, but it's also totally possible that it gets invoked two or three times. And you have to plan for that. So that is important. The same is true if you have a messaging bus, so like SNS or Kinesis or stuff like that. So also there, typically a message gets delivered once, but it might get delivered twice or multiple times in rare conditions. And you have to plan for that. And it's no excuse to say, oh, no, we don't handle that. Our support team can do that on a phone call with the customer. That's not an excuse, because things can go really wrong here, especially when AWS faces outages or stuff like that. So you have to really think about that. And it's not that easy to do that. So that's what I want to highlight. The other thing is many of the messaging services also do not guarantee a proper order of the messages. So again, you have to think about that. What happens when, I don't know, the message for unlocking the car comes, I don't know, after the message for starting the engine of the car, something like that, yeah? So that's possible because many of the services do not provide a guarantee for deliver messages in the proper order. And the third thing is also a problem in distributed systems is when you modify data, reading the data is eventually consistent. At least, so there are many options to get it in a consistent way as well, but you have to pay for that typically by with money, basically, and also with latency and maybe even availability. So you have also to deal with that problem that data will be stale, might be stale when you read it. So you have to plan for that as well when basically architecting or programming. So all of that is, if you don't have that in mind, and AWS does not talk too much about those things usually, so the marketing slides say everything is easy with serverless, but really these are highly distributed systems, and AWS does its best to abstract away those challenges, but some of them are just for you as a developer to solve. I think that is what you need to plan for. And that is why I would say that, the skill of a general understanding of distributed systems is really something that you have as a training goal or hiring goal when, finding the developers and architects for your serverless architectures.
Yeah, Andreas, I can provide one maybe example here that I encountered recently. So when hiring people, so what I prepared was, and this is kind of like an example for a discussion, not only about testing knowledge, but also about testing if actually there's awareness of the problem, and you can use that to either make sure that you train people then properly. So show them a Lambda function that does two things. For example, Step number one, put something into DynamoDB. Step number two, put something into SQSQ. And then the only thing I did, basically, I asked what can go wrong with this code? And I mean, obviously, for example, it could fail when you put into DynamoDB. So then maybe nothing happened. Maybe the function retries. It could also fail after you put something into DynamoDB, but before you put it into SQS. And then nothing is in SQS, but it's in DynamoDB. If it retries, you will maybe insert it twice into DynamoDB, but only once into SQS. And I think this is a good example for starting the conversation about the problems that we talked about with this. Basically, in the end, it's about idempotence. But I think this example is very helpful to kind of get the conversation started. Like a simple function does two things, but yeah, both calls can fail, and they will not roll back because this is not a distributed transaction. And I think that's kind of what this example is about. It's very small, but still it captures so much concepts that you have to keep in mind. So that might help as well to get the conversation started in a team. It doesn't need to be a hiring process. It could also be just sitting down and review the code and looking for things like that.
Okay, Michael, definitely. So let me close our discussion. Or do you have something to add?
No, I'm fine.
Perfect. So I think from my observation, more and more large companies are adopting serverless. But I think there's really a huge gap between what those organizations are used to from their on-prem or cloud infrastructures and serverless. So I think be aware that it will take time, energy, and money to basically make that transition. And on the other side, all the projects that I've observed and that I've accomplished is they were really turning into a great success at the end. So they were able to deliver an application built on serverless, and it was working very well in the end. So I think it is worth going down that route for some applications, definitely. But keep in mind that this is basically a transition, and it will take some time. So that's maybe my summary here.
Yeah, thank you very much, Andreas, for discussing this topic with me and with all our listeners. So that was, I think, lots of interesting points made here. So thanks for that.
Did you learn something new by listening to this podcast episode? Tell your friends and coworkers about it. And also, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Want to deepen your knowledge about AWS even further? Besides our monthly podcast, we are publishing a video every week. Stay ahead of the game with independent insights into AWS. Within the past few weeks, we published videos about Kinesis versus managed streaming for Apache Kafka, CloudFormation modules, and DNSSEC with Route 53. Subscribe to CloudOnNote Plus to get access to our exclusive videos and online events. You will find more information and a link in the show notes. Help us to improve our podcast and motivate us to record future episodes by sending your feedback via Twitter, LinkedIn, or email. Find our contact details in the show notes. Thanks a lot for listening. We will be back in about a month. Bye. We'll be right back.